From P.E. Monroe Auditorium at Lenoir Ryan University in Hickory, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When most of us walk down a sidewalk, we see the sidewalk. Our guest tonight sees the cracks, the little bumps, the minutiae that make up the sidewalk, and he sees the sidewalk. More importantly, he seems to understand intuitively how all those particles, cracks, and bumps that are contained in the sidewalk inform the sidewalk and our experience of it. But Chuck Klosterman doesn't write or particularly think much about sidewalks. He's an observer of pop culture. We spend our lives immersed in that culture, but he has a particular talent for seeing things we miss and bringing to our attention the nearly invisible connections that tie all of the elements in that culture together and which inform our collective experience of the world in which we live. And, of course, he writes about it, and that is why Lenoir Ryan University invited him to be the guest for this edition of their Visiting Writers series. Klosterman is an essayist and best-selling author of both nonfiction and fiction who has been called the best pop culture journalist of his generation. He's written for Spin, GQ, Esquire, ESPN, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, to name just a few. His latest book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. We'll talk about that and a lot more over the course of this hour, so join me in welcoming Chuck Klosterman. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Yeah.
I'm glad the intro took that turn. I was like, boy, I don't know if there's a lot of questions about concrete. I am not that prepared. Like, I have done very little paving in my life.
You can talk about the cracks.
Yeah,
in the
it's a bad job. You know, wrong mix, not enough gravel or whatever.
Yeah, it is said that you have a cult following, many of whom may be in the audience here tonight at Lenoir Ryan University. But for those people who are not in the cult, but who perhaps have read you from time to time, talk about how somebody who grew up in North Dakota, and you can hear that North Dakota accent slipping out just a little bit here and there, worked as a journalist in Fargo, North Dakota, eventually came to New York and experienced tremendous success as a writer and an observer of pop culture. How did that come to be?
Well, boy, you know, I guess it's like they always say it's like two ways, you know, gradually and then suddenly. That kind of is how it works out, you know. I grew up in North Dakota on a farm outside of a town of 500 people. There was like 23 kids in my graduating class. My dad was a farmer. My mom was a housewife. And I went to the University of North Dakota with really no idea of what I was going to do with my life. I mean, I assumed I would probably end up majoring in English and becoming like a high school English teacher and a basketball coach. I only applied to one college. It didn't even occur to me that kids applied to lots of colleges. I grew up in a different place and in a different time where the idea of trying to plan your life was really rare, you know? But I just sort of stumbled into journalism. I found out that if you worked for the college newspaper, you got paid, which I thought blew my mind. I assumed you did it for free. Like, in high school, you worked for your high school paper for free. I was like, oh, they pay for this? So I took this job, and it turned out that I could do it, and I really loved it. And I just went into journalism, basically, right from there. And worked at a newspaper in Fargo for 4 years, and then moved up to a job in Akron, Ohio. It was kind of a mid-level paper, and, you know, I moved to this city where I didn't know anybody, but I was making more money because they had a union. And I could buy a computer for the first time in my life. And what do you do if you have a computer and you have no friends? You write a book. So I decided to write a book. And I wrote one. No, I really didn't know if it would get published. I guess I just wanted to see, could I write something that would be as long as a book? And I must have really wanted to do it because I'd work all day and then go home and write at night. I could never do that now. But at the time, I did. I'd come home at night and I'd basically from 9:30 or 10 till 1 or 2 in the morning, I would work on this book. And when I had half a book, I thought, well, I've seen books worse than this. Like, it didn't seem like the worst book I'd ever seen. Like, I feel like I'd even seen books maybe that were slightly worse, you know. So I just started sending it to, weirdly, I was writing a book about heavy metal music. And heavy metal was so unpopular in 1998 that I thought the only way I could get a book about heavy metal published was through an academic press. So I was like, I'm going to write about the sociology of heavy metal. So I just started sending it out to like Duke University Press and Harvard University Press. And I got a letter back from a woman at Columbia. And I really wish I had this letter. I owe this woman so much. She wrote me back and said, well, we can't publish this book for two reasons. One, we're an academic press and you swear too much. and the other is that the most interesting parts of this book are when you talk about your own life, which I was just totally doing out of necessity. Like, there's no academic precedent for writing about Motley Crue. Like, you just can't find it. So I have to be like, well, my friend John liked Motley Crue, and this is what it did to him or whatever. So I went back, and I wrote a bunch more stuff that I guess was kind of memoir-y. And then I chopped it all up and put it in chronological order, and I had a book, and I sent it to New York, and then they published it. And then that's how it all happened. That was the beginning, and then I got hired by Spin Magazine and moved to New York. And
so I take it, then, that you were into heavy metal music at some point in your life.
Well, that's all I listened to.
All you listened to.
It's the only. In fact, I listened to it so much that I didn't like. I went to college and I was at a party. This is in the early 90s, and a song came on, and I was like, "This song is going to be huge. This song is so great." And it was "Come On, Eileen," which had come out like 10 years prior. But I was so into metal, I wouldn't even listen to the radio. Like, I'd wake up in the morning, like, bomb, bomb. I wouldn't even play the radio on the chance they might be playing pop music.
And you hate the Eagles, and you're not terribly fond of Bruce Springsteen.
The thing is, I
guess applause?
The thing about the Eagles is weird. Like, for the longest time, I never thought about the Eagles. Then I became a rock critic, and I realized I was contractually obligated to hate the Eagles. Because all rock critics have this adversarial relationship with the Eagles, or at least that was the case.
You know, I read that today, and I had no idea that was the case.
Oh, yeah. There's, like, some artists that for a long part of rock's history, the Eagles were one, I mean, Billy Joel is another, I mean, Celine Dion is somebody who that it's really rare to find a critic appreciate them, especially in the way criticism used to be. So then I sort of adopted all this reasoning for why I hated the Eagles, which was all kind of an intellectual creation that I then injected into the music and heard it back, and I was like, this is terrible. And then one day I listened to it again, and I was like, why did I think that? I don't know why I did, you know. I felt suddenly different about them. I still don't like Bruce Springsteen that much, but.
So you were into heavy metal, I take it, in high school, is that right? But I think you went to Akron to work for the Akron Beacon Journal to be the art critic.
Well,
that's
how you got that on Wikipedia. On Wikipedia, they say I'm the arts critic, which wasn't even a job.
No, I said art.
Oh, you thought like fine art.
Yeah,
art. That makes actually would make more sense. Weirdly, I got hired.
Not in Akron.
Yeah, I got hired in Akron. Yeah, that's true. They had a new position called the pop culture reporter, where I was going to cover popular culture. The only problem was there was a music critic, and he was cool, but he didn't want me writing about music too much, and the TV critic was extremely territorial and did not mind me writing about television, and the film critic was kind of the same way. He was a good guy, but he was like, I reviewed the films. And there was also a religion reporter, and he wasn't too jacked about me writing stories about youth and religion. So I had to write about popular culture without writing about music, television, film, or religion. So I did a lot of stories about skateboarding, people who were thinking about the new Star Wars movie coming out, and Y2K. I did a ton of Y2K stories.
I guess the revenge is the fact that all those critics who didn't want you writing about their beats no longer have jobs.
Well, you know, I gotta be honest, the music guy who became my friend, he's now at Newsday. So he moved up. TV guy's still there. Film guy's in Cleveland. The religion guy's a great guy. He retired. So I got to be nice to all those people.
Well, now, you eventually got to New York. You went to New York to write for Spin magazine. did you ever feel, I mean, you're a farm boy out of North Dakota. You don't talk glowingly about your education, even your college education, and you felt that you learned more in college from your friends than you did from your educational experience. Did you ever feel intimidated about being in the media capital of the country and writing for this big magazine? I guess it was a big magazine at the time. Did that ever enter your mind that perhaps maybe
I was totally worried about it. Yeah. I was very intimidated. I kind of think if you're not, you're kind of a weirdo. The kind of person who is really filled with confidence all the time. It's like, I don't want to talk to that person. Like, it's natural to be worried about these things. You know, when I went to Spin, the thing that I assumed was that it was going to be a real kind of competitive, isolating experience and that everybody would know about music and that's all they'd want to talk about. And then when I got there, it was like, these are people who are just like me. Like, for the first time in my life, I would be in an office and everybody was like me. They liked the same things. They had the same sense of humor. Somebody would make a joke about Jethro Tull. Everyone would laugh. Everyone got it. You know, it was great. It was just this dream scenario. To suddenly be around these people who I felt normal for the first time. I'm probably one of the few people who moved to New York and then felt normal.
So what were you like? What was life like then for you in North Dakota? If you were abnormal, were you the precocious kid?
I had no idea. It was weird. I thought everyone was weird in the same way. I remember sitting in English class and there'd be like the teacher would ask a question, and the answer would seem obvious and nobody would raise their hand and neither would I, because I was like, obviously everyone is too cool to answer these questions. I now realize I was probably the only one who knew what she was talking about. I was probably the only one who read what was in the book, you know. So I blended in. I had plenty of friends in high school, you know, and I was a small enough school. I was in sports and all of these things, so I never – I mean, I wonder now if I was actually super unpopular and too dumb to know it. I mean, it's very possible. I mean, I think to myself now, if I described what I was interested in, if I made a composite character of that and put it in a movie, it would be like Napoleon Dynamite or something. But it didn't seem like that at the time. It seemed, you know.
Yeah.
My world was smaller, I guess.
Well, you have the ability, and I alluded to this in the opening, of writing about a lot of different things and finding the tiny, almost invisible threads that tie these things, these seemingly disconnected things, together. When did you notice that you could do that?
When did I notice that I could do it? I guess the thing is, I probably maybe always did it. I didn't realize anyone cared until I started getting paid for it. Before, I thought it was just annoying. Like that I would just be like, I've just always been this way, that I'd be watching, you know, a political debate, and it would make me think of a film. Or I would be, you know, watching sports, and it would make me think of disco or something. And I would see things in it, to me, that just, it wasn't like I was mining for these things. I just would be like, oh, well, there seems to be sort of a kind of a metaphorical relationship between what these things signify. And I guess that's what I started writing about. But I had no idea that it was seen as either good or bad. Like, it seemed like it's a strange thing. I mean, it's probably the thing that I've built my life around, but because it actually is one of the few things that did come naturally to me, I don't even know how to describe it.
Well, I'll pull that out of you in a moment. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're on the campus of Lenore Ryan University at the P.E. Monroe Auditorium. Thanks to their Visiting Writers series, we are spending the hour with Chuck Klosterman, best-selling author and writer. His latest book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined, which we'll spend some time talking about a little bit later on. And coming summer of 2016, I'm told, but maybe we're wrong.
Yes.
What's that about?
Well, a while back, Fox rebooted the TV show Cosmos. And I rewatched it. It was like Neil deGrasse Tyson was the host, and I really enjoyed it. And the things I enjoyed most were the moments where they would discuss from the past, these kind of hinge periods where maybe everyone thought something about science until 1636 or whatever, and then somebody would come forward and have a new idea, and the entire world would shift with it. And I thought, well, that's interesting, you know? That must be happening all the time, that these things that are sort of just absorbed to be irrefutably true are suddenly changed. And then around that same time, I was reading about Moby Dick. I wasn't reading Moby Dick. I was reading about it, though. And I was sort of reading about how Herman Melville, he thought this was his masterwork, and then it came out and didn't sell that well, and the critics were really mixed, and he basically was pushed out of writing and kind of became first a poet and then an alcoholic, and then he worked in the customs department, and then he died. You know, and then years later, around a little after World War I, there was suddenly this rediscovery of Moby Dick, that this wasn't just a good novel, this was like the American novel. So there again, I thought, well, this must also always be happening. This idea that these things are existing in our world that we overlook because maybe the future isn't, we're not ready for the future. So then I thought, well, what things exist in our culture right now that in 100 or 300 or 1,000 years will seem absolutely absurd? And how do we deduce that? And the way you do that is you have to look at the present tense as if it was the distant past. So that's what this book is. The book is basically looking at things that are subjective and objective, you know, science, literature, rock music, sports, all of these things, and trying to sort of think about the present tense as if we're looking back on it, you know, in 300 years, and what will be lost and what will be retained.
Is it frightening when you do that? I mean,
I'm going to be dead either way. So it's
Does it make us look foolish when you think about it that way?
It's, you know, well, first of all, I mean, I guess in a way, like, okay, easy, like, here's an example. Like, okay, prior to the 1600s, people's belief in gravity was based around kind of, you know, prior to Newton, was like based on Aristotle's ideas. Aristotle's ideas was like, why doesn't a rock float? Well, a rock doesn't float because it wants to be in the center of the universe, and the center of the universe at the time was believed to be the center of the earth, so it's pulled down to the ground. A rock wants to be on the ground. That's why it doesn't float. It has a desire not to float, you know? Well, of course, this is not true. We know that now. So was Aristotle foolish? Well, in a way, that's a pretty smart thing to come up with based on nothing, you know? They had no testing. They were just like, how does it work, you know? Another thing Aristotle thought was like, why is the sky blue? And he was like, well, I think air is imperceptibly blue. And if you get a whole bunch of it together, the way like a glass of water looks clear, but a well looks dark, it's like if you get enough air lined up, you see the blue sky. Okay, there again, not true at all, totally wrong, but a pretty good guess, you know? So a lot of these things that we accept now that will later seem crazy, are they really foolish, or is this just the highest potential we have to understand certain things about life?
If we look back in 100 years at the biggest pop star in our universe today, will Taylor Swift seem superfluous?
100 years, okay. So 100 years from now. Well, let's look back, okay? Let's look back 100 years in the other way, okay? So we're early 20th century, right? Well, how do we view that now? Well, we kind of blend it all together, right? We jazz and sort of like skiffle music and all the, you know, big band music, we all kind of lump it together. So that's going to happen to our time 100 years from now. You know, someone like Taylor Swift actually is probably in a pretty good position to be remembered, although the things that someone will be remembered for aren't necessarily tied to the music itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
I bring her up because you just wrote a big article about her, and I want to talk about that article and how you approach doing the interview that you did with Taylor Swift. You do what I do as part of your job. You go out and interview people from time to time, and you spent how many days with Taylor Swift?
Oh, not that much.
Not that much?
No, I met her for lunch, so we had maybe an hour and a half lunch, and then we had maybe a 45-minute or a half-hour car ride, 3 hours maybe at most.
Does it feel artificial to you
Well, it is artificial.
Of course, completely artificial.
Yeah.
Like this.
I mean, it is. Yeah. I mean, you know, just for the people listening on the radio, I'm talking to you next to a lamp that's not plugged in. Okay? Like, if you're listening to this on the radio, you have to imagine a stage with two nice chairs, a table, and a lamp, and like a bookshelf behind it. Now, why do these things exist? To kind of create the illusion for everyone involved, even though everyone here knows it's fake, it's all like, oh, this sort of symbolizes what the conversation is supposed to be like. So when I'm talking to Taylor Swift, the thing that I have learned from doing this long enough is that I'm not one of those journalists who attempts to get the person having, you know, like an organic, natural conversation that we're almost like friends. I pretty much say right up front, look, you're here because you are selling a product. Maybe the product is yourself, but this is why you're doing it, okay? I'm here as a reporter. I can ask you questions that your friends can't ask you based on this fake sort of interaction. So within this inauthentic thing, let's see if we can kind of get down to those little glimmers of real moments. That's sort of what I feel an interview usually is. It's an attempt to sort of talk a lot in order to get to those singular moments where some reality kind of bleeds through, and then you learn something about the person that allows you to sort of enjoy and interpret their art differently.
Yeah. For somebody who loves, and I guess loved and maybe still loves, heavy metal, is it difficult to talk to a Taylor Swift and to understand her impact on the world? Because you say in the article, there is simply no antecedent for her kind of career, a cross-genre, youth-oriented, critically acclaimed colossus based entirely on the intuitive songwriting merits of a single female artist.
I mean, it's not hard at all. I mean, if I was 16, maybe it would be. If I had the mentality of a 16-year-old, you know. But the thing is, the person I was, like when I was most into metal, that had been like 8th, 9th grade. That had been the most I was into it. Well, what real relationship do I have with me as an 8th or 9th grader? I mean, I don't even have the same cells in my body. Every cell in my body has been replaced 3 times since then. So, of course, I'm totally different. I mean, when I look at Taylor Swift now, I sort of see her as an adult and as sort of somebody who has studied culture and music, not consciously, but almost inadvertently through my job, thinks about these things a lot and is more open-minded. I mean, if one good thing has happened in my life, I feel like it has been just a continual increase in the openness of my mind. But, you know, now I'm 43, I have a kid, I'm having another kid coming. I wonder if, like, now the door starts to close. Like I have friends, you know, who have kids, and you know, we used to party together and be crazy, and then we start talking about our kids, and all of a sudden we're saying these insane reactionary conservative things that I also now totally believe because I have a kid. You know, it's like it's weird.
Well, you talk about your open-mindedness, but you know, as you get older, people generally disconnect from popular culture, and you have made your living as an observer of the pop culture. Do you worry that it will become disinteresting to you as you get older, that you won't be able to relate to the next Taylor Swift whenever that comes along at all?
I mean, I worry about two things. That somehow I will lose my engagement and it will be like I'm a person looking, you know, at plants from outside the greenhouse or whatever. And I also worry that, like, am I wasting my life by sort of letting myself be consumed by the things that the way culture works are really designed for people going through a phase of their life when they're consuming art to sort of create who they are. Now I am who I am. I mean, but this happened real quick. I mean, even in my late 20s, I went to college with a guy who loved the Smiths and Morrissey. These kind of British bands. He loved them. He had this huge Smiths poster over his bed. He loved them, loved them, loved them. He became an engineer. I became like a rock critic. So I call him on the phone and I'm like, hey, so the new Morrissey record's out. You know, it's called Maladjusted. You know, it's like, what do you think about this? The reviews are really polarizing. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, he had no idea Morrissey was still putting music out. Because he already had, like, for the most people, for the, like, you know, even probably for many people in this audience, maybe less than most audiences, because if you're coming to listen to me talk, you're probably kind of into this stuff. But like for most people, when they get to be about 26 or 27, things like music kind of stop for them. The idea that music kind of got bad when they were a sophomore in college. That was the last period when it was good. And it really kind of galvanized and calcifies. If you fight through that, though, like I did, when I say fight, it wasn't like boxing, it's just like I hung around. It's like then you kind of keep going. But it's really natural for people to sort of have these cutoffs. You know?
So who do you listen to? I used to be able to ask questions like, what's the CD in your car stereo? Yeah. But people don't do that anymore. And you live in Brooklyn, so you probably don't have a car.
I don't.
So what do you listen to? Who do you listen to?
I mean, I have always been sort of fundamentally like a rock person, like metal, classic rock, particularly the music of the 70s and the late 60s, you know. And that really has receded from the culture. You don't really, like rock music is now kind of this niche thing. So there are still artists that I'm very interested in, and I go on Spotify and I try to listen to what the new music is, but I'm actually kind of moving backwards now. Like I'm kind of moving into early rock, pre-rock, and jazz.
It's happening, Granddaddy.
Yeah. Well, here's actually what is more. Partially is it I'm aging, maybe. But here's the other thing. It's like I kind of have listened to most of the rock music. Like I really have. Like yeah. I think that I've listened. Like there are artists that I'm not familiar with, but there are not many artists I'm not familiar with. So it's like I've kind of heard it all, and now I feel like there's something interesting about the things that were this foundation to that to me. I mean, I think this is sort of a natural process too. I think that at one point in a lot of people's lives, they suddenly become interested in history because they are realizing that their life is now history. That their life is now a historical document.
They have context.
Yeah, you know, you do. You have, like, it's... I mean, I like getting old. I like knowing things that other people have to learn. Like, I think it's great when, like, you know, like, if, like, the Iran hostage situation comes up, I was like, I remember that! Like, you know, somebody else is like, I read about that, and I was like, oh, well, this is what it was like. You know, I was 8 or whatever, but still, I remember it happening, you know? And I like that. For me, it's sort of like... things will come up. Someone will say something happened in 1986, and I gotta say it doesn't feel that long ago to me.
It wasn't.
I realize it was.
So pop culture is more than music. It's also television. It's movies. It's books. It's what's happening in clubs and things like that. Do you watch television for entertainment? For your personal pleasure.
Well, okay.
And what do you watch?
Yeah, my wife is the TV critic for Entertainment Weekly, so I watch a lot of television.
Boy, do
but
you.
I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it for work, though. I mean, yes, I watch a lot of television. In fact, I'm much more engaged now with television than I am with music or film, partially because maybe of the status of my life, but also because television is really peaking now. Like there's never been a period, and this is no brilliant insight. There's never been a period where there's as much good kind of quality, sophisticated television as there is now. And you know, plus I watch tons of sports. So, I mean, there really isn't a day I don't watch television. If you're asking me, like, what television shows?
Yeah, what do you watch?
Let's see.
You watch a lot. If she's the entertainment or the television critic for Entertainment Weekly, she's watching everything.
Yeah, but the bad stuff she watches at work. Okay. Like the boring stuff.
What's the bad stuff?
Oh, almost anything on a regular network.
Okay.
Like, you know, if she has to watch like a CSI show or something, or like Scandal or these things.
Yeah.
It's like we watch Fargo. We watch Survivor. We watch Empire. We watch a lot of things on Netflix. We watch this show BoJack Horseman, this animated show on Netflix. Man, we loved that. It was another show called Bloodline. I really liked that. All the high-end HBO stuff, Game of Thrones, all of those things, all the AMC shows that are now done, like Mad Men and Breaking Bad, we watched all of those.
I was going to ask you about Survivor as a joke, and you brought it up.
Yeah.
It's my guilty pleasure. I love Survivor. Why do you watch it?
Well, the thing about Survivor is that, okay, so it debuted in like the year 2000, and it really was like almost the epitome, the definition of like what a pop culture phenomenon would be. People were kind of baffled that they were actually doing this, putting people on an island. It seemed like something that would have been a joke on The Simpsons 5 years earlier. Now they're actually doing it, and everybody got into it. And then for the most part, few people watched the second season, and it kind of, most of the world kind of disappeared. But there's some people who hung with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened with Survivor now is why initially it was a normal reality show where it was like, here's a trucker, here's a model, here's a dentist, oh, here's the black character, here's the Asian character, all the kind of those, like, you know, everyone was sort of stereotyped as having one identity. And then there was also this element of strategy. Now it's only strategy.
Right.
And I love that.
And it's history. It has its own history now. And the players know it.
It has its own history and its own language. And, you know, I did a podcast with Jeff Probst. And I sort of talked to him about this. I think that the TV show Survivor, now you may think this is overthinking, but I think that it does illustrate something that's sort of troubling about the nature of reality, which is that in Survivor, the first people who get eliminated are the old, weak people. And then the next group that gets eliminated are the threats, the people who appear like they could win. So really, to survive on Survivor, you need to exist in a level of mediocrity in the middle, while still having a desire to be on television. So what kind of person wants to go under the radar on a TV show?
A winner.
It's a weird thing. It's a weird thing.
But isn't that what life is like?
That's what I mean.
That's the sad part. Yeah. If you rise above the crowd, you get shot at.
Yes.
In real life.
Yes.
It's the drones that make it through to the end.
That is very true. And I think that maybe when a lot of people who watch Survivor, they don't think that, but they like the show, and maybe that's what they're sensing. I'm a big believer in this, that a lot of the things when we talk about popular culture that seem sort of like almost like academic or like, you know, the kind of things that only maybe a person who is trying to come up with an idea comes up with, I think that these things are really in there, and that the average consumer is sensing that, but they just don't want to say it's like, I watch Survivor to understand life, because you sound like an idiot if you do.
Well, I want to remind people that you're still listening to NPR, even though we're talking about Survivor, with Chuck Klosterman on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from P.E. Monroe Auditorium on the campus of Lenoir Ryan University. As part of their visiting writers series, they've invited Chuck Klosterman, and we've crashed the party. He's a writer, has 8 books to his credit, 2 are novels. One's coming out this summer, which we talked about a little bit earlier in the process. And his latest book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. You write about so many different things and in so many different forms. You write essays, you write about pop culture, you write novels. What's your process? Where do the ideas come from? How do you know something is going to be a good essay? How do you choose the topics of what you write about in novels? Is it a way to say things that you wouldn't say or couldn't say but want to say in your essays? That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the question in a way. It's sort of like, how do people come up with anything? Like, how do you, if someone's a director or if they're a musician or whatever the case may be, it's like, how do you come up with this idea? I started as a journalist and like a daily newspaper reporter, and I think an outgrowth of my early writing was the fact that I felt like limited by sort of the impersonal nature of newspaper writing as it was in the 80s and 90s. That like you couldn't be in the story, you were supposed to be as distant as possible. So I thought, like, well, I would like to sort of write about the ideas I have and the feelings I have, sort of, you know. And that's my first 3 books are very much like that. They're sort of like the sensibilities of a journalist who's no longer sort of limited by the art form of journalism. But then, you know, I felt like maybe I wrote about my life too much. And there were things that I would often interview somebody and I would almost wish that, like, I would find myself thinking, I know what you want to say, or I wish you would say this, but you just won't do it. So I had to write novels so I could make people say what I wanted them to say.
It gives you control.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, that's in writing in general, in all senses, the thing that I like most about it is that writing allows me to control reality. It's the only way it can be done. That, like, you just, when I wrote those novels, it's like you start with, I would say, a blank page, but that's not really true anymore, a blank screen. You just have this blank screen, and everything that's going to exist in this world you have to create. And that's fun. I mean, that's an exciting thing. I feel like I'm honored that I get to do it.
I want to come and talk about your latest book, but before we do that, I want to talk about something that seems out of character, and I don't quite understand how it happened, or maybe I'm just ignorant to ask this question, but for a long while you wrote the ethicist column for the New York Times. Stephen King, who likes you a lot, said you dispensed uncommon wisdom on moral conundrums from those who wrote in. What prepared you to write the ethicist column?
Well, okay. I read the ethicist column when I moved to New York and I loved it. I thought it was just a great idea. You know, and who's qualified to do it? Well, you could make the argument no one is. And you could also make the argument everyone is. I mean, who is really qualified to have people bring them problems and say, you know what, this is what you're supposed to do? At the same time, everyone's alive, right? Everyone has a life. Everyone has these experiences where ethics kind of come into play every single, you know, in every interaction you have. So I was like, well, I would like to do this. You know, I would like I felt as though that a lot of my other writing, like I would want to write about the idea of faith. But in order to do that, I'd have to write 4,000 words about Tim Tebow to get to this core question. Like, I'd have to build this whole superstructure of why I was talking about the idea of how sort of faith operates to the average consumer. So I was like, well, this will cut right to the chase. This is somebody saying, like, look, here's what's going on. What should I do? I kind of viewed it almost as non-fictional thought experiments. That people were giving me their real problems, but they weren't really looking. The person who wrote in, you know, if you wrote a letter to the ethicist, it took a while to get there. I had to read it. I had to think about it. It had to get published. If it took 4 weeks. Any question took 4 weeks to get in. So it really wasn't a practical thing. I was really writing not for the person who asked the question, but for all the other people who would read that question and say, I see a corollary in my own life. Mm-hmm. It seemed like an interesting job.
I'm going to misquote him, but I think you gave an interview to somebody in the local newspaper here in Hickory, and it was in the paper this morning, where you felt a lot of pressure because it took you a long time to think about the answer to the question, and you hoped that the answer wasn't destructive. I'm paraphrasing there.
Well, it was. It was a real anxiety-creating job because you'd get asked a question, and there'd always be like a superficial response. It would seem obvious. But of course, if it's obvious, that means that it's probably flawed. So I would spend a few days thinking about, you know, trying to go deeper, trying to think in a way that, like, what's not the obvious answer, what's the real answer? And then I would write it, and then I would take another day off, and I would go back, and I would look for the flaws in it and the problems, how I would attack it if I didn't agree. And what I found is that I was just worried about it all the time, partially because the culture is so volatile now. It seemed like anything I did wrong could feasibly end my career. Well, the upside would be like people would be like, "That's okay this week." like the risk reward did not seem in balance. It seemed like I could end my writing career or be seen as being okay. So like a new editor came in, he wanted to make changes, and I was like, "I'm ready for this to be done." To be honest, I'm ready to move on. Like it was I kind of view it as a failed experiment in my life.
Well, let's talk about something else that people really liked and are upset that is no longer there, and that's Grantland. Mm-hmm. After ESPN had a falling out with Bill Simmons, I think his name is, they shuttered that site, which I think he had a lot to do with starting. And we had a social media question from the North Carolina Writers Network on Twitter this afternoon, asking me to ask you, how do you view the future of publishing in the wake of Grantland closing, and what does it mean for sustainable long-form writing?
Well, okay, for people who don't know, Grantland was like a sports site and a culture site. Simmons started it. I was the first person kind of involved with it, and then we hired a lot of other people. It was really all Bill Simmons, because Bill Simmons is this incredibly powerful, incredibly popular force. He was the highest paid employee at ESPN, so ESPN kind of allowed him to create this site. It ended up collapsing, not for financial reasons, which I think some people think. It was totally personal. It was issues between Bill and ESPN, and it became real spiteful. I have to say that in the 20 years I've been in media, this is the first time I've ever experienced an operation with that much money at stake being decided solely for personal reasons. But in terms of the question that the person asked, like, Grantland had this huge advantage in that it had unlimited financial resources and therefore no demand to make money. Like, ESPN looked at it sort of as almost, I hate to say vanity site, but in a way that's what it was. It was like, well, we can lose money on this as long as we do good work, because in their mind it was good for the brand of ESPN. Like, so much of ESPN is criticized and is cheap and just terrible. So they're like, well, we'll have this thing where we'll do really good work, and it will sort of act almost as a balance against, you know, like, you know, guys screaming at each other in the morning about whatever. Now, because of that, we were able to do things that would be very difficult to do in any place where money is at stake. Like, we would send some guy to cover the Iditarod for a month, and it would take forever to write, and, you know, it'd get an 8,000-word piece. And everyone said it was good, but not many people actually read it. There's a real problem. I mean, this idea of, like, you know, in some ways the future of long-term journalism seems better because it's so easy to access and so many people have the ability to do it. It's going to be harder and harder to make money at it, though. And eventually that just creates this weird impossibility.
Is there a market for it? Can you make money at it when we live in a world that is becoming increasingly inattentive, where Twitter is where we get our news?
I would say you probably can't make money at it. I mean, I don't really think that someone's going to have to come up with a new model. Like, some people will, like, there'll always be a demand for it, and there'll be a small number of people who are always able to do it. But, I mean, okay, in the 80s and 90s, all this period before, in journalism, there was this central problem. Like, when I worked in the paper in Fargo or the paper in Akron, there's this central problem. No one knew what stories were being read and what stories were not being read. You'd put the paper out and you'd know how many copies of the paper you sold, but you had no idea which stories were actually attracting people's eyes. So that was always a conversation. What's being read? What's not being read? And since no one knew, there was only one option. The option was, well, we just got to try to do the best possible job using our own judgment. You know? Well, once the internet came into play and you could actually statistically track stories, you no longer had this question. You could actually see what stories got attention and which ones did not. And this really damaged journalism. It was a real damaging thing because it's impossible not to sort of filter all your attention to what people want, even if what they want makes them less informed or maybe less serious. I mean, it would be almost be like if you – this seems really derogatory to the world at large, but there's some truth in this. It would almost be like if you had a 9-year-old kid and you said, like, hey, for the first time, we're going to allow you to pick what you want to eat all the time. You know, and you know, and that your judgment now, what you like, will become as big a factor as what your parents think you should have. And that's sort of what has happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had more time to talk about that, but we only have 4 minutes left, and I want to talk about I wear the black hat, grappling with villains real and imagined. It's a treatise on bad guys and our preoccupation with them, and you go into a lot of different things. Among those things, you bring up the fact that something I noticed, if you grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the bad guys on television, the bad guys in movies were bad guys. We liked the heroes, but suddenly, with the advent, I guess, of Tony Soprano, we liked the bad guys. We see the bad guys on Breaking Bad. We like Walter White. even the guy on Mad Men, Don Draper, not a bad guy, but kind of ambiguous. We liked him. What's going on?
In some ways, it's a technological problem, weirdly. I mean, because you can find the idea of, like, the anti-hero in literature way, way back. And then if you look at film in the early 70s, like during the auteur movement and stuff, you know, like some of those Nicholson movies and the Godfather movies, the idea of the villain being the good guy kind of emerged there. And if you look at popular music, really in the 80s, with both with metal and particularly with hip-hop, that kind of moved more in the early 90s, the idea of, like, gangster rap and stuff, the idea that people are drawn to sort of like the dark light thing. But in television, for whatever reason, because I think it was seen as the most populist medium, they were very hesitant in allowing this to happen. If you go back and watch an episode of Miami Vice from the 80s, for example, like there's a drug dealer on there, but the drug dealer's always bad, right? Mm. If you watch a television show now, like Breaking Bad or The Wire, if there's a drug dealer, he's almost inevitably interesting or positive in some way. It's sort of like with Tony Soprano, like when David Chase made The Sopranos, his big fear was like, will this character repel viewers? Like, can I get away with this? And it turned out that they actually were drawn to it. So what actually, to me, if I had to answer this, like, I think this desire, this interest in villainy has probably always existed. It's just emerged in different mediums at different points.
So I've heard somebody else talk about that. That's really interesting. But is it also happening, or is it having an effect, do you think, on our politics? Because you write about certain political figures in this book, among them George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Rick Perry, yeah. Newt Gingrich. They're all Republicans.
Bill Clinton in there, too.
And Bill Clinton. Yeah. But if I understand you correctly, at least half of those people do not qualify as villains. Does anybody running in this election qualify?
Well, okay, sort of by the standards that I've... Okay, in this book... I work a little differently than I think other people. Most essayists, like, they come up with a thesis and then they kind of try to defend that thesis. I kind of do the opposite thing. I write about what's interesting to me and I try to see if there's a thesis in there.
Okay.
You know? So the thesis I ended up coming up with sort of was that well, it's not a perfect example. The villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. Okay. In other words, the person who understands how to manipulate the world and understand how the world works, but has the least emotional investment. So like somebody like George W. Bush, I said, was not really a villain. I don't think anyone looked at him as someone who knew the most. Or cared the least. I mean, I guess Kanye West accused him of that, but I don't think that was really true. It was really more like Dick Cheney. He seemed to be the person who seemed to understand these things and not really care what the consequences were. So if you look at the candidates now, there really isn't a Republican like that. Mm-hmm. There really isn't a Republican candidate who seems to know the most and care the least. Probably, if by this definition, someone like Hillary Clinton is closer to that because she has been like a career politician who has seemed to spend her entire career in a way to get in this position, almost ancillary to what being president means. Like, I don't look at Hillary Clinton as a villain, but among the candidates running, she comes the closest to that definition.
Mm. With regard to Donald Trump, you think that he will burn out by Super Bowl time.
I didn't think that, yeah.
You don't think that anymore?
Well, that was my prediction.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's going on in the zeitgeist right now that the loudest man is running neck and neck with the quietest man, Ben Carson?
I sort of think that when I see people, when you talk to somebody who supports Trump, who likes Donald Trump, or who likes Ben Carson, you rarely hear them say, I think he'd make a great president, or even necessarily, I want him to be president. What they are really doing is, it's almost like a form of political protest, that because I have a real disenchantment with the way the culture is going, very often, I hate to use this term, but like with political correctness, the idea that sort of that the polarity has shifted and now that the way America used to be has shifted and young people now seem to be censoring adults or whatever the case may be, however they look at it. It has to do with this idea that there's something wrong with the way the country is from almost a personality standpoint. So they look at someone like Donald Trump and they're like, I'm going to support this guy, this who I might think is a lunatic, because he's like an amplified version, a hyper version of the anti-political correct person. Now, what is interesting is we get closer and closer to the Iowa caucus. How long are these people going to kind of continue essentially supporting someone they don't believe could be a president? I mean, I think it's a totally ideological thing where they don't view him as a good candidate, but they like this idea that he represents as a corrective to the way the world is or the way the world is becoming.
Chuck Klosterman, thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.